Good morning. So we're going to finish up on impact benefit agreements today. Part two. These are the two general topics we're going to look at. We're going to go back to that last slide that I finished last lecture on Monday and talk in a bit more details about some of the implications and possibilities. And then we're going to look at some alternative approaches to impact benefit agreements and consider the possibilities of these devices really actually being able to fulfill First Nations' long-term strategic interests or not. And that will lead us, following this, on, I guess, Friday, to talk about co-management agreements, which tend to be developed between government and First Nation, whereas the impact benefit agreements tend to be primarily industry-driven documents. Okay, so that's where we're going with this particular discussion. So this is the slide that I had down last day, and from so these four basic ideas here, that impact benefit agreements, when you look at some of the implications in terms of, these are the implications that affect the ability of a First Nation to actually achieve a long-term strategic goal of autonomy and independence, and that would fulfill its rights and title. If you look at the implication in terms of the economic benefits, the kind of normalized view within a market economy, if you look at the idea of economic benefits, employment opportunities, capacity building, and if that is your normative model, and are you measured by how many people you add in and how many dollars in each of those lists, you probably would arrive at a relatively positive take or positive understanding of impact benefit agreements. But that would be a model or a normative model of evaluation of IBAs premised upon market individualism that actually ignores the overall strategic potential of an Indigenous nation's rights and title. And so, in effect, it allows industry to sidestep the entire issue. So these are the implications to look at the way in which the IBAs actually undermine an ability of a First Nation to achieve these longer-term strategic interests. And I am pretty sure that somewhere in a kind of business-oriented course, perhaps even at this university, maybe not, at the very least in the boardrooms of some of the major companies in this country, people actually sit and say, how do we manage and negotiate, how do we set these things up so that we facilitate our economic rate of return and we diminish the opposition to what we are about to do by bringing on board the opposition as quickly as possible. And the way large corporate boardrooms look at bringing opposition on board is, how much will it cost? And that's not a criticism. That's the way market economies work. That's the way businesses look. They balance the kind of risks and benefits, the costs and revenue models. They compare the kind of long-term profit and revenue flow against the short-term obstacles. And they kind of weigh these things, decide, is it really worth our while to move ahead in this area? And these IBAs have become a relatively cost-efficient mechanism to diminish opposition from First Nations and to lead First Nations to defer or to turn their back on exercising their potential rights and rights and title through litigation or more direct engagement with the government. Now, in this particular article that Kane and Krogman have written, they go through some of these implications. And I want to summarize some of their arguments and their discussions, because what they've done is probably one of the most thorough reviews to date of the publicly available IBAs that are out there. And one of the first things they mentioned, so much as I said, is kind of the positive take that, and I'll just read a quote here. In the current context, given improvements in agreements to protect Aboriginal interests, one might argue that power is shared through IBAs and negotiated by appropriate community leaders through the following, i.e., and then the following models of appropriate community leaders, or pardon me, negotiation through, one, equity ownership and revenue sharing provisions, which is one of the things we talked about, employment quotas for local or Aboriginal people. And so if it's the First Nations signing it, they'll require a certain quota. And these aren't sort of minimum expectations. UBC, for example, has a policy. I think they've changed the slogan. It used to be 2000 by the year 2000 in reference to Aboriginal student recruitment to this institution in terms of, and at any one point in time, the actual success rates are far less than the projections. So they've actually change some of their strategic slogans around that. But the point is that targets don't necessarily turn out to what actually happens on the ground. So the idea of looking at sort of employment quotas, assurances for participation by local businesses through the Aboriginal group's right of first refusal for contracts for the project. That's often a very key one that it will be included. And so what the company will say, we're going to have X hundred million dollars worth of heavy machine operating contracts related to road building. It's like the Port of Prince Rupert, for example, in its expansion. Of course, in the second tier expansion they just announced a little while ago, they'll offer some of these preferential contracts. So what they'll say is, we will guarantee up to, say, $100 million or $200 million or $300 million of contracts for road building or fill or quarrying to you. But this is a preferential. It gives you a first right of refusal. And then they actually have down further in the document will say you need to comply with these particular industry level standards. You have to have this degree of capacity to hold a bond in case you can't carry out your work. So it's not a guarantee of the contract or the opportunity. It's merely saying that there will be an opportunity for a certain proportion of the contract to be done by First Nations. And then they might also add a clause saying if there is a First Nation joint venture firm with another firm, they will actually give another second tier of preference to a joint venture firm, etc. And so these tend so far to be fairly marginal, but they're because the companies say the work's going to be done, and if it's going to make people happy, we'll slide a bit of work over to the First Nation, but you have to meet our standards for how that work's done. It's not an unreasonable business expectation, but you have to think of it in terms of what the goal, what the underlying goal or objective really is. The requirements for a measurable financial and income outcomes to be defined and published by the industry. So often they'll make a publication about what the income and what the outcomes of the projects, that's part of the agreement, you have to announce it. Establishment of monitoring committees for the IBA implementation. And then there's a whole range of other degrees of types of participation of Aboriginal people. The authors here summarize, and this is a key point, what these documents focus on is what I've been talking about, this idea of market individualism, that at the end, driving force behind these agreements. IBAs appear to share power, so this appears to share power with First Nations, to the extent that Aboriginal people have been successful at obtaining agreements around a number of benefits from the development in exchange for continuing presence. But these benefits tend to be restricted to contracting opportunities, employment opportunities, and some kind of equity sharing with the First Nation. None of these actually address issues of rights and title, though it's the implied threat of a First Nation's exercising of its rights or title that puts First Nations at the table. So it's an interesting dynamic. So lurking in the background is the fact of the legal doctrine of rights and title. It's not addressed by these agreements, but it's what puts the First Nation at the table, and the company says, how do we facilitate the process? Keeping in mind that a part of the other backdrop to this over the last 30 to 40 years has been a progressive diminishment of the size of government civil service. Why does that matter here? What relevance does it have? Well, government civil service used to coordinate environmental assessments, environmental monitoring, policing, enforcement, testing of a whole range of things, from food industry to logging, mining, fisheries, you name it. There was a whole structure of government monitoring and enforcement. What's happened since the great, the early late 70s, early 1980s, what's now often referred to as neoliberal turn in government, at the time it was just, it doesn't matter. It's now referred to as a neoliberal turn in government. The object was to reduce the size of government, and one of the first things the government did was lay off staff. Of course, they then went and contracted them back. BC in 1983 laid off massive numbers of government employees, and in things like the Ministry of Environment and the Ministry of Mines and Forestry, they had hired back a great number of these people as contract workers, which ultimately cost more, which is the kind of weird fiscal irony of this whole process, because the private contractor has to, the argument would be cheaper, but then the private contractor needs to cover their own overhead in certain ways. It's a very kind of funny thing. A former brother-in-law of mine who was a civil engineer working for a private engineering company, his entire two or three floors of the building he worked in became seconded to the Ministry of Highways through developing major road developments in the mid-1980s, following this kind of so-called restraint package and the firing of staff of workers. So there's a whole range of critiques about what was actually going on with these kind of maneuvers and how they're transfers of wealth in different directions. But what that means is that there's nobody on the ground actually monitoring these things. So the reason why the reduction of government staff, what happens, gets to be a bit of a problem, is that they can't actually, there's not enough government to really do the work. And so a lot of things get overlooked. Just in the news this morning, the union that represents the 900 plus workers at Rio Tinto Alcan in Kitimat took the government to court and Alcan over an environmental assessment approval for the expansion of the aluminum smelter. Now, this might seem counterproductive because the workers there will benefit from the expanding of the facility because there won't necessarily be more jobs, but there certainly won't be less jobs after they're done. But one of the things that they were criticizing and said leads to a problem of bias, and they're concerned about the health of the workers who will be right at the place where sulfur dioxide is going to be released into the atmosphere at a higher rate than has previously been the case, is that the person who was the lead for the provincial government's environmental assessment process was, get this, hired and contracted by Rio Tinto Alcan to ensure that their permit would proceed at an expedited rate. So that's a kind of interesting. Elkin says this is not really an issue of bias. It's merely what a reasonable action to take in a case where there's insufficient staff and they had a lot of permits to process, something 250 to 300 different individual permits to do this kind of work. So part of the idea of the oversight that's happening and with the reduction of government staffing means a lot of these things get shunted to the companies, and then there's nobody really to check on the oversight of these processes. I mentioned this last day, I just want to reemphasize it, that very often IBAs are signed after major investments have taken place. So there's already a big drive where the machinery is geared up in terms of the capital has been put in place, a whole amount of exploration and planning work has occurred, and then a number of pre-approvals through government have taken place, and that's the moment at which the IBA negotiations often start to take. And then they occur against a very accelerated and rushed timeline against what is often presented as a fixed and hard wall. Though I've seen some negotiations last too long, last for a year, about 2 years after the so-called hard deadline that they had to be negotiated. Sometimes that works out when the project is continuing, but I've also seen in some cases when the agreements weren't reached over a period of time, the project actually ended up fizzling. So there's a great big wind farm project off on the Haida Gwaii in the North Shores that was planned some time ago. It's currently essentially dead. It might come back, but a lot of the infrastructure behind it, and so not every First Nation had an impact benefit agreement signed with that company. Some did, some didn't. Some received benefits, some didn't, depending upon the nature of the agreements and when they signed them. So what ends up happening, though, is IBA become more about mitigation than about enhancing local opportunities. So they transform. So some of the implications of these agreements, they're about mitigating potential adverse impacts as opposed to transforming the actual arena within which people are playing. Now there's a constraining, I mentioned this about the issue of confidentiality and the kind of compliance clauses. So the authors here state, while IBAs may facilitate development profits for proponents in exchange for sharing the benefits and offsetting some of the negative impacts of development, a constraining element of the exchange can be found in two provisions found in many IBAs, confidentiality clauses and non-compliance clauses. So the confidentiality clauses restricts holistic discussions of benefits and valuable experiences among communities that are negotiating IBAs. We talked about this a little bit the other day, but if I'm negotiating an IBA with Adam, and you're negotiating one with Adam, but we're not allowed to talk to each other. We don't know. Now, Adam might say to me, hey, look, I'm giving you the best deal. And, you know, you really have the most at stake in this. You're the closest First Nation. You've got more community members, and you guys are really on board with this. We're really giving you the most money. I don't know that. I might actually think Adam's telling the truth. I might have a little gut feeling of suspicion, because my cousin over here has told me that what kind of the details that they're getting, and it sounds pretty sweet, different than what I'm getting. And so I'm not sure, but then, of course, who knows? We also know that when he goes fishing, he always boasts that he caught 100,000 pounds of fish. When we see his tallies, it's only 50,000. So I'm not really sure whether I believe him or not. But it means we don't operate in a full information playing field. The other thing that happens is that when Aboriginal leaders enter into these essentially quasi-legal private agreements, they have made a de facto decision to enter into a private agreement unchecked by government bodies or their counterparts who are deliberating over similar benefit issues. And this effectively reduces bargaining power. So in a sense, when community leaders go in to negotiate behind closed doors, they actually lock themselves off from their own communities as well as other communities and effectively weakens their negotiating power. Because they really, you know, the perspective of these authors and ones which I would share, the only people who really benefit from that confidentiality, and here I apologize, Adam, I'm going to use this new example, is Adam, the large corporation. He's the only guy who's going to benefit from keeping it all confidential. And so it undermines that kind of openness, and it also allows for the cultivation of a kind of it seems to be quite acceptable in the corporate world. We have these people who are kind of free folk broker type characters who position themselves, and they don't they might be free consultants, they might work for a company, but they what they're doing is facilitating access to meetings, and they can make a fair bit of cash out of doing that. And what this ends up doing is transferring some of the indigenous leadership into positions like that. They become what in the old-fashioned Marxist terms is a comprador bourgeoisie, a member of the local or colonial elite, who is, in terms of their social class position, but whose well-being is completely dependent upon the colonial powers. So if the colonial power was ended, their actual economic and power would also be undermined.
Are there any cases of like distrust between different groups and groups that may all be an individual agreement, but say that not everyone's going to get a piece of pie from whoever's there first will get it because it's companies have reduced?
The way it typically, so the question is, have there ever, I guess you could boil the question down, are there disagreements between First Nations, and are there sometimes where some First Nations who are first assigned the agreement through that act of agreeing, it preclude other First Nations to be part of the agreement? Short answer is yes, that does happen. The longer answer is a little more complicated, given that the rubric that's used to determine who has the most relevance at the table is something called a strength of claim test. So again, even though these agreements aren't about rights and title, they are, ironically, all about rights and title. So what will happen is the proponent, working with the advice of a government official, who now we know from the Alcan case might actually be contracted to the to the corporation as well, a government official will determine for the proponent the relative strength of each of these First Nations claims in terms of rights and title. And there's a rubric, and it's emerged out of some of the court cases with the Haida over as part of the way that this has emerged as a sequence of court cases. And so you get this nice spectrum from almost 100% guaranteed that you will, if we went to court, you would have right, you have title over your land, to somebody who is actually, it's really, really weak. There's no evidence. It's hard to say. You guys are stretching. This is, and that's how, in these meetings, I've heard government officials say that to people. So I'm not actually inventing this language. They say, you're stretching. You're really stretching our credulity here with what you're saying. And then the companies use this information that the government has prepared to who they're preferential negotiating with. You merely need to look at the principle of port authority to see who the port authority has actually signed direct primary agreements with. And then you have a kind of circling out of other nations who have agreements. This sometimes leads to court cases between First Nations or between First Nations and the proponents. Going to court is a very expensive, time-consuming and process that rarely, in these cases, really doesn't seem to have much of a positive benefit, I think. Leaves a lot of anger. In addition to this issue of confidentiality, you have what can best be called a gag order. So you have these built-in non-compliance provisions that prohibit Aboriginal groups from undertaking any action to delay a development. As these authors refer to it, the gag order in effect curbs democratic processes to lodge objections in the event of new information that may come to light as the development proceeds. Non-compliance clauses in IBAs are an indigenous provision to ensure compliance without having to resort to the kind of American-imposed public legal tools such as strategic lawsuits against public participation or protests, slap suits. Though you might have noticed that there was, in a sense, this kind of a parallel kind of slap suit was used with the Kinder Morgan protests against people up on Burnaby Mountain. Was it only last fall? Seems so long ago now. But they used, again, some of the people, they used that kind of technique. It tends not to be used as much in Canada, that kind of legal action, though there have been a few cases around farmed salmon. There was some years ago some legal actions against people protesting, but anyway. So... So these non-compliance things are quite very, very clearly worked in, and as soon as you violate a non-compliance clause, that's it, boom, you lose the benefits. So if you've already seen this as a kind of last-ditch effect, and if it's a relatively speaking a large amount of potential revenue or cash, and the tendency, the whole dynamic is to hold things down. It also causes, I think, very poisonous internal reactions in terms of communities because, first of all, the agreements are confidential. That means they're not necessarily nor always shared with the wider community. Sometimes they are. Sometimes they're shared in general summation forms. Sometimes they're not shared at all. People merely say, here are the benefits we're getting. We can't share with you. Trust us. And these often small communities, people oftentimes do trust and match. It's also family. Sometimes there's family. If you think of it, families don't always agree with each other. And some don't necessarily. So it becomes rocky. It actually acts to intensify, I believe, and magnify internal divisions and disputes. This is not, of course, a new thing. It's a tool, a technique of governance and power for a long time to figure out the ways to angle in and chisel groups apart so that, because it's easier to deal with the group if they're divided and engaged in internal conflict because it makes them less efficient, less effective at actually acting upon their rights or advocating for themselves. So there's a whole range of technical aspects in which this is quite a deleterious kind of process. Now there's, I think, a more important one, or well, not more important, how these are, but which leads to some of the issues that sort of highlight some of the ideas about potential alternative things, but in most First Nations communities, by and large, there is a close link between development and social norms and cultural values. Oftentimes, the internal processes are based upon a form of consensus building and negotiation between different segments of the community. Now, this happens differently in different parts of the province. So on the coast, where we might see fairly hierarchical structures, there's still an internal sense of consensus building and discussion, debate that's embedded within that process. In some parts of the province, that tends to be more lateral, more horizontal, the sort of structural relations of power, but again, which then makes it even more focused upon the sort of consensus building and exercises. But these ideas, these core cultural values, are subverted by the key capitalist indicators and benefits used in these agreements, i.e. employment, training, and business opportunities. The whole purpose of the IBA is to transform the relationship into a purely capitalist market relationship. Makes sense, we live in a capitalist society, but in a sense, because it's happening outside of the realm of government-to-government negotiations, and it's happening from a First Nation to a industrial proponent, and very often it may even be the development corporation of the First Nation that's engaged in these negotiations, it essentially transforms things basically not to a set of collective rights, which is what Aboriginal rights and title are, to a set of individual possibilities and opportunities. And so it actually then transforms and shifts the capacity of communities to continue if people chose to. If people chose to maintain traditional kinship structures tied to practices and linked to the land base. In Kakatla, people often say that a chief's name is empty if it's not attached to its land. If the land is destroyed, i.e. the territory, the lakiu, the place where that chief's name is rests, if that is destroyed, the name is destroyed and there's nothing left. So one of the things Kakatla has tried to put into their agreements under these environmental assessments under the so-called valued component section is this issue of governance linked to the preservation of the value of the land for the continuation of traditional practices. That doesn't typically happen in IBAs because the companies say, well, no, let's just talk what we can control. We can actually offer you the possibility of a $150 million contract over 5 years, and we will provide joint, matching dollar funding with the government for training for X number of community members to learn how to operate this equipment. And so the whole objective is to pull away from, and essentially, which ultimately serves in one sense to undermine the structural basis, the contemporary practice of which these Aboriginal rights and title are premised upon. Okay. So on the face of it, Aboriginal people might appear to have successfully negotiate benefits for which they have not been able to negotiate until recently. So there is a positive. There are benefits coming, accruing from these documents. But a lot of the Aboriginally identified, Indigenous community identified social justice issues are not addressed through IBAs. The whole issue of rights and title, the whole issue of the capacity to continue one's cultural practices, to maintain and enhance one's language. Because essentially, language is tied to practice. I mean, i.e., there's both the practice of practicing it, but the way in which it's used in terms of the engagement. So the terms for the places, naming places. You know names of places by going to them. It's one thing, yes, we can all figure out where Baffin Island or Greenland is or whatever on a map, but to actually know a place and to know its name in an intrinsic sense, you need to move across that space and know its name and hear its name spoken in its context. And so, to certain extent, IBA agreements don't deal with that at all. I mean, you could argue, and some people will try to say, well, we take the money we get from that and we'll fund an education program, a language training program in the community schools, and that will be a benefit that will allow us to continue. But that's a benefit. I'm not convinced it's one that actually maintains the capacity to carry on. Okay. So as I said, this kind of analysis leads to a fairly dismal look at IBAs. And the question becomes, is there a possibility within this model to do something different? Of course, it does require some effort, some thinking about this, and some possibility. But for a moment, let's consider that. And what I want you to do is just take a few minutes here and think about yourselves and think of the different things we've talked about as the course has gone along, different ideas, thinking about the problems of the agreements and the nature of the way these work. What do you think might be what types of agreements might lead to better outcomes for First Nations communities? By outcomes here, I mean outcomes that link to the strategic possibility of exercising one's rights and title. So I'm not talking about outcomes like the IBA normative model is, outcomes of jobs, education, employment, et cetera. But how can we structure an agreement that might actually lead to outcomes linked to a nation's strategic exercise of its rights and title? So just take a few minutes. I will ask you to hand those in to me, and we'll mark them off as just like, you did it kind of mark. We're not evaluating what you say, because this is an area where I'm pretty sure if we did the same exercise in many communities, we'd get a whole range of things from not sure to some interesting idea. So just take a minute or two, and then maybe send them up. Maybe Adam and I will pick them up from you. So we're not going to let you have much time.
Thank you. just a short sentence. So, and yes, it is a hard question to grapple with, but it's one that I think a lot of people are grappling with this question every day. Sometimes the speed and the intensity of these kinds of negotiations don't allow for people to kind of think laterally or outside the box. Part of the other problem is that there's a whole infrastructure, one might almost say industry, that's risen up of lawyers and financial advisors and business consultants who are more than happy to help First Nations figure out a way to get the best dollar value outcome, the best number of joint venture contracting opportunities, the best training programs. And so the whole structure is flowing in a particular direction. It's like trying to cross a really fast flowing river that without any help or support. Or there is a lot of help. There is a really nice, kind of comfortable barge type boat sitting in the middle of that river that's saying, come on, jump on, we'll help take you down the river. Bad pun. So, put your lasso down to rise and extend them to the side, and we're going to come. Like a great big, you know, they have these great, beautiful aluminum boats, and they're wonderful, except when you think what the purpose for. We've got a couple of them based in the north coast of BC. They're about 55, 60 foot long aluminum boats, nice high speed. But they have these great big wings that drop down onto the water edge because they're skimmer boats. Where the coming potential, the not coming oil spills. They're very big skimmer boats with big wings, and they look beautiful when you see them on the water. But they only can work, in waves up to a couple feet at most, in winds. I don't think they can work for more than 15, 20 miles an hour, which in the north coast of British Columbia is creeping up all the time. But they are beautiful boats. I know the pressure. I'm just going to talk about reading. Okay. We've got them all in. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at these. Now I'm going to raise some of the ideas that I have, but I'll look at these, and then on Friday I'll come back with them and have a little bit of a discussion about as we move forward. It's quite possible that some of the ideas that I suggest, some of you will suggest it, and it's also very likely that you will suggest ideas that I haven't suggested up here. I guess it's a form of crowdsourcing, yes? Well, I think, from my perspective, one of the most important things to try to figure out ways of doing is to support land-based activities. But we also have to keep in mind that two-thirds of our communities don't really live in our home communities anymore. So there is a problem, and you'll see when we talk about Glenn Cotard's book, he also talks about the idea of land-based ethics and the importance of this, and there is a problem. I think we need to be able to figure out how this becomes a priority and is maintained as a priority, but also when more than two-thirds of community members don't live on reserve communities or village communities or have complete and easy access to one's home territory anymore. What does this actually mean? It's hard to say, but one of the things, though, that reasons why proponents really don't want to do this is because a lot of times the land-based activities that they would be supporting are seen to be low economic value. So imagine, there's about, based in Kitkatla Village itself, there's probably about 50 regular, consistent harvesters. There's about 450 people live in the village itself. So that's a kind of a high proportion of people. But that means not everyone is doing this, right? But that group of people is regular, consistent, and providing food and materials to a wide range of people, both in the village and outside the village. So it has an important social value for the community. But if you're moving up and down and around the coast in a 16, 20-foot aluminum skiff with an outboard motor, operated by crews of 2 to 4 people, which are mostly family-based units of labor power, and you're going through, you're moving, you know, harvesting some fish. Maybe you go down to a fish site and you catch a couple hundred salmon. You bring them home and they're canned and distributed, given to some people. The proponents think, well, we want to put a gold mine on that place, and right where you guys are fishing, I mean, we'll be careful of the salmon, but we want a gold mine there. We want a barge loading site there, and we want to have a cruise ship. A cruise ship that will act as a bunkhouse for 60 to 100 people when we gear up. And we're going to want you to stay away for a lot of time. Now, the dollar value on the gold mine and its overall net generated to the provincial government, and maybe if it's an IBA, even to the community leadership. That's a high, and of course the profit, the shareholders, etc. That's a real big operation. And compared to the one household family group that's going there, that is actually maintaining their practices and community engagement, etc. They say, hey, this is an impediment to our capacity to continue our operation. And the company would much rather negotiate, because it's easier, a royalty or some kind of profit sharing mechanism than to maintain or move their facilities or operate in a way that does not disrupt the local harvesting. Now, they look at it as a pragmatic thing where they try to balance the things. They're not being directly obstreperous, I would argue. Though I certainly know that sometimes community leaders and community members feel that these companies are being obstreperous, are being oppositional. So that's one idea. Enhanced customary governance. Now this is an interesting idea because it's really quite problematic when you start to work it out. It doesn't really fit with a hierarchically, top-down, structured, capitalist sort of fast response management system. Because what it typically means, if you're going to be enhancing customary government, you're going to be setting up structures in that IBA that would suggest something like, first off, house leaders in the territory in which you're operating would have to be consulted and approved before anything happens. Then that would mean that some house groups might be yes, some house groups might be no if it's over a large, a big area. And so the company is thinking, no, we want one single voice to actually figure this out. And we like the idea of democratic pluralism where everybody casts a vote, or whoever is responsible, one person speaks for them. So there are problems. People have tried to move this, and in some cases there have been modest success in this area. But very often, once the people who are negotiating on behalf of the proponents realize what's involved, they dig in their heels real quick. A parallel here on campus, for example, that's a kind of parallel idea, but it's a kind of a play. It's a kind of tactical engagement. Some years ago, before they started putting housing on South Campus, that's the other side of 16th. There was a big working group, and they invited faculty, residents, staff, students, and neighbors to get involved. And at one point in the discussion, they were talking about how they're going to deal with the trees. And the plan was, you remove all the trees, and you institute a tree replacement policy. This is the ecological model of planning. You have a tree replacement policy because they said, okay, there's a value in having trees. Now, what they hadn't mentioned is the trees they were removing were 80 and 90-year-old second-growth Douglas firs. And the trees they'd be replacing them with were relatively new ornamentals along the margins of the roads. So one comic in the crowd suggested, how about a biomass replacement policy? So if we're going to talk about ecological balance and maintenance, let's just have a biomass replacement policy so you don't actually have to do a count every tree, you just have to measure them up. And initially the developer said, that's a great idea, that's brilliant, that's very nice. And then there's kind of pause, the wheels start to overturn, click and gears, and all of a sudden there's this interjection, no. They realized, of course, biomass means a direct one-for-one replacement. And even in some of the environmental mitigation plans around eelgrass, for example, rarely do a one-for-one mitigation or one-for-one replacement. They often do an equivalency of some manner that isn't actually parallel. So, I mean, this is one possibility as well, enhancing customary governance through these models. I think one that's probably easier to do but raises some political and legal questions is shifting from economic benefit, But you see it written up there. Go from economic benefits to a form of taxation or royalty model. Now, interestingly enough, this isn't really a new idea. In fact, the Kikalachi Palatsevasa in 1888 or 1890, I'm not sure exactly, entered into a benefit sharing arrangement with Williams Fishing Company. And he rented for a period of 5 years two fish creeks for the sum of the time of $100 for each creek. That's a lot of money in the late 1800s. And it's quite interesting because that was an economic or impact benefit agreement. It was a contract. It was placed upon an equal footing. But it was actually a rental rate for the access to use it. It was not based upon profit sharing. And in fact, the fact that Williams Company only actualized one of the fish creeks and fished out of, it was too bad. It was $100 for each of them, and you paid the rent, and it was a taxation kind of model. So that's one possibility. I see we're counting down quickly here, but we'll just pick up. So there are some obstacles here, and this is one of the continuing ones, one of the real problems is that for a lot of the things that would actually enhance or support the strategic interest or the long-term strategic possibility of rights and title First Nations require government signatures. The companies can't actually sign away some of these rights, even though they've been put in the place of negotiating on behalf of the Crown and continuing the Crown's consultation process. They can't actually sign away those rights, which is another reason why they keep limiting themselves to economic arrangements. And somebody in government must have figured this out, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to look at this and say this, because it's the government's benefit to defer, I think, to defer and constrain the recognition of rights and title and to push things along this other way, because if you hold out long enough, people oftentimes, it's the feeling, will give up. It's okay. We've gone as far as we can. We've tried. You get internal pressure, and if your community is suffering, is cash poor, employment poor, having the needs immediately met by the promise of big bucks is pretty hard to say no to, no matter what one's outlook. Which brings me to where we're going to be looking at is that very often, in an interesting sense, because co-management agreements are signed between a First Nation and a government on a nation-to-nation basis, a government-to-government basis, very often you can get better outcomes that meet with or mesh with the strategic goals of the First Nations. Typically these agreements say without prejudice to existing rights and title, but of course what drove those agreements very often is the reality of the potential of the rights and title, and it's a way of, again, in one sense, it's a deferring the resolution of the question, but effectively design co-management agreements, not ones like on the herring cases, which the First Nations had to take the government to court, because those co-management agreements, essentially the way they've worked out, DFO holds the final decision-making authority. But co-management agreements provide another alternative, and that's what we're going to start talking about next day. So on next day, I'll come back with some of the solutions you guys presented, talk about those, and then start talking about co-management agreements and how, as an alternative, they have there's better aspects than in terms of the IBA. Thank you very much.